my version of a successful race is, regardless of what happens, if the racers never see that problem or feel the effects of that problem, then it's been successful on my end. It doesn't matter how many fires I've had to put out.
That was Jamie Knott, and this is episode 142 of the Inspired Souls podcast. Hi, I'm Carolyn, and I'm a roadrunner.
And I'm Kim, and I'm a trail runner. Welcome to our podcast, where we bring the communities of trail and road running together and explore the parallels between running and life. Jamie Knott is a 48-year-old mountain trail ultra runner and father of three from Calgary, Alberta. He is a senior safety codes officer in Rocky View County and race director for Iron Lakes Mountain Races and Racing Dusk. He was inspired to host these races as a way to showcase the amazing trails in and around the Elbow Valley and Bray Creek and provide world-class racing opportunities in the beautiful mountains close to his home. Jamie is a USCA certified running and ultra running coach with 22 years of trail running experience. He has raced distances from 5 kilometers on the road all the way up to 100 miles on the trails and has completed races including Black Canyon's 100K, Iron Horse 100, and Hurt 100. Jamie will be returning to run the Western States Endurance Run for the second time in just a few short days. We hope you enjoy this conversation with Jamie. Well, Jamie, welcome to the Inspired Souls podcast. We're really looking forward to getting to know you a bit better tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to sit down with you guys for a little while.
Yeah, I think this is a little bit overdue. You're quite a fixture in the Alberta running community, and I've had the pleasure of interacting with you both at your own races and at other races in which you were running. We've had other race directors on and other runners, and you wear both hats, so it'll be really interesting to find out more about all the things that you do. But why don't we get started with you just sharing us a little bit more about yourself. Where are you coming to us from? And yeah, what do you do with your days?
Currently, I'm in Calgary, but I grew up out on Vancouver Island. So spent my youth out there and into the, I guess, into my 20s before working as a carpenter. The economy and such drove me out this way because of work. So originally thought I'd be here for about a year or two until I could get a job back on the island, and here I am 25 years later, still in Calgary. So,
what part of the island?
Town called Lake Cowichan. It's about halfway between Victoria and Nanaimo. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
both Carolyn and I have spent time living on the island. So for me, it was the opposite. I went for a year expecting to be there for a year and was there a lot longer, but now I'm back. So you came to Calgary, and what do you do in Calgary now?
I work for Rocky View County. So I am a building inspector for them, looking after kind of bigger projects and stuff like that. So I've been there for about 17 years.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about your athletic origin story. You are now, you know, a person who has established a lot of miles on your feet and in a lot of amazing places. But where did it all begin? Were you always a runner, or did you start out as a younger person playing, you know, a variety of sports?
Probably like most kids, I ended up starting in soccer, which is sort of where I think most parents throw the kids because it's a great way of just burning off energy, and it's not an expensive one either. So started there. Got into a little bit of running in school through like Terry Fox Run, and they had a little local triathlon and stuff like that that I did a couple of times as a kid. But then ended up playing football, basketball, other things at school, but never really took to running until I met my wife. So it started with she was a runner. She had been running her whole life. And when we were dating, just started dating, she's like, "Do you run?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, of course I do." "Okay, let's go." Next thing I know, we're on a 10K run that I think we did in 50 something minutes, and I couldn't walk for 3 days afterwards. Oh, no.
But you couldn't let her know because you knew that you were a runner.
That's right. I could not tell her. Yeah. That's right. Yes. So, that's sort of where the the current running started was that on a run on Vancouver Island, getting forced. Well, I guess it was more ego driven.
Yes.
So,
well, there must be a lot between, you know, keeping up with your wife for a 10K and being sore for 3 days afterwards and running multiple ultra marathons. So where did the love for ultras come in?
After that, when we got married, we were living in Calgary and she went down to the running room one day to get, I think it was shoes or, but she came home with the brochure for the first death race.
Oh.
And she's like, we got to do this. And I'm looking at it and I'm like, I can't run that far. Like, are you kidding
me? So for those
me?
That don't know, the Canadian Death Race is 125 kilometers. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were going to do the relay and I'm like, okay. So I hummed and hawed about it. And finally she convinced me, let's do it. So I found a couple of other friends and we got a team together and went up there and just with the training for that, we did that one in 2000, so August of 2000, and I really enjoyed it. It was so much fun. So I'm like, well, if I can do that, my wife's like, we got to go off and do a marathon now. And I'm like, well, you know, I've did over half of that distance, so okay. So trained a little more, and then we went and did Victoria Marathon that fall. So in 2000,
beautiful.
Yeah, and then we kind of stuck around to that marathon distance for a few years before running, I guess it was it in 2003? It would be technically an ultra marathon. We were in Spain and ran the Maratón del Pino de Madrileño. So it was just outside of Madrid in the mountains there, and it was like 46 or 7 kilometer race. So I guess technically that's my first ultra marathon.
Okay.
And then from there it was Lost Soul the following year in the 50K, and then just kept adding distance and adding distance until up to the 100 miler. So
that's, yeah. So you've been in some interesting places. If somebody wants to check out your ultra signup, they'll see races like Black Canyon's 100K, Iron Horse 100 miler, Hurt 100 in Hawaii. You've even done the Kneenacker on Vancouver's North Shore, I believe. Yeah. So it's not an ultra, but I've never done it. But from what I hear, it takes a lot out of you. Similar to, what is it, about 30K, I think, Kneenacker?
No, it's 30 miles, I think.
It is 30 miles. Oh, okay.
So it's just under the 50K.
Right. Okay.
So
tell us a little bit about that. I know it's been a while since you've done it, but what's the Kneenacker like? And why does it have a name like Kneenacker?
Oh, it's just up and down through the North Shore. So I did it because it was close to, on family holidays, going to Vancouver Island, and it worked scheduling wise and that sort of thing. But I got there completely unprepared for that race. I had not done the vert that I needed to do or the training I needed to do for that one. And I paid for it on the later miles. My quads blew up because that downhill at the end was so tough because it was straight up and then up and down along the North Shore and then straight off the back down to sea level again. So.
Well, that's why they call it the Kneenacker, I guess. You're not the only person who blows out their quads and knees on that race.
No.
It's got quite a reputation still.
Yeah.
Okay, so the big one, Western States Endurance Run. You were there for the first time in?
2017.
So 6 years ago. Yeah. And in almost exactly a month from now, so a week from when we're going to air this podcast, you will be back in Squaw Valley for a second time running Western States.
Yes.
So let's talk about that. Yes. Let's talk about all of that. So I don't know where to start except with, you ran it 6 years ago. You can't help but learn something. when you do a race, whether it's positive or negative. You learn what you're going to repeat and you learn what you'll never do again. So let's just jump right in there to how has your training gone for this race and what did you learn the first time that is informing how you're going about it this time?
The big thing that I learned was the heat training. I didn't do really too much heat training at all last time. And I would say within 15, 20 miles into the race, I was already paying for that lack of training for the heat. So that is sort of the one thing now coming into the last month that I'll start hitting the sauna and developing that tolerance or try to build up some sort of tolerance for that heat. Because the canyons when I was there in 2017 were over 40 degrees.
Ooh.
So hopefully it's not that hot this year, but you still got to prepare for it just in case.
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely. So in 2017, you did it in 28 hours and 35 minutes. So you avoided that golden hour. You came in with a nice cushion.
Yeah.
What other things are you going to do this time that maybe are informed by what you learned last time? So even with the heat, maybe heat training, but are you going to use ice in a different way? The creeks, did you plunge last time?
I spent too much time probably getting wet last time.
And the
benefit was that it was keeping me cool, but the downside was my feet were wet the entire time.
Yeah.
And by the time I hit probably that 75 to 80 mile mark, my feet were so trashed that it hurt to walk. Like I had bad trench foot, essentially. So I'll have to pay attention more to that, whether it's keeping cool, but making sure I change the socks more often, change shoes more often, whatever it takes to keep the feet dry and a little bit looked after a little bit more. It's kind of hard to avoid them getting wet. In 2017, it was a big snow year. So the whole high country was, we were post-holing to up to knee deep at times, still in snow. So there was a lot of snow still. So hopefully, this year it's going to be the same. with the snowpack that they've had this year, we're going to deal with the same issues, I think, anyways. Outside of that, probably just more ice, whether it's tucking it into the vest, under the hat, bandana, anything like that, that'll help cool off also. So
last year I noticed a relatively new trend is people weren't just using the bandanas and the ice, you know, in their packs, they were dumping it in their shorts. Like they were trying to keep the core cool right from the belly. Not asking you if you're going to do that. I'm just stating, I noticed there's been an evolution in how people use ice. You pretty much can't get enough of it on your body during that race. So hopefully it's not going to be a 40 degree year for you.
Even if it is, I will not be putting ice down my shorts.
See, this is a running podcast. We just go there. We just ask the question.
Yes.
Hi, nice to meet you. Will you be putting ice down your shorts for your next race? Relationship accelerator.
He's like, I will never be a repeat guest on your podcast.
I've learned a thing or two. I'm a road runner predominantly. I've learned a thing or two about trail running in the couple of years that we've been doing this podcast. But what I do know is that Western States is an awfully hard race to get into. How have you managed to get into it twice in the past 6 years?
I have no idea. I got into it the first time with one ticket. Yeah.
Like you really won the lottery.
Yeah. And my wife ran it in 2010 and she got in with one ticket.
Oh, okay.
And then this time I had 8 tickets. So it was only 4 years that I'd been in the lottery this time that I managed to get in again. So I don't know.
It's not fair.
I know. I don't tell. I guess everybody knows now. I haven't told too many people because I tend to get dirty looks when I tell people I've gotten in on with so few tickets every time. So,
Well, and only getting in on one ticket, it means you didn't your reset wasn't a huge reset when you back to one for the year after 2018. Some people get in with like, you know, 16, 32 tickets and then they reset back to one, but you didn't lose a lot.
No, no. And then it's kind of nice now that they allow you to carry over so you can just pause for a year or 2 years instead of automatically having to put in every year or you reset to zero, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So different people use crew differently in Western States. So what is your plan this year as far as who's helping you, who's supporting you? How are you going to make the most of the people that are there to support you?
Originally, I've got 4 crew coming down. So my wife and 3 friends are coming down. And originally, back in December, my hope was to split them into 2 crews and they can take each side of the course. So I can see I get 2 extra crew stops that way. However, with the flooding and everything they had and the fires, the one road on the one side of the course is closed. So it's just going to be back to the usual. First stop will be at Robinson Flat, roughly 50K into the race. Won't see them again until Michigan Bluff at just over, 54 miles, I think, or 55 miles into the race. So then it's back to the same as every other year for crews. So, and then I'll have 2 pacers. One will start at Forest Hill to Green Gate. And then second pacer Green Gate to the finish.
And who are your pacers? Are they, you know, good long-term friends of yours? Or are you pulling in some ringers?
Both, I guess. so one of them's a friend. He came down last time, and paced me back in 2017, and him and I bounce back and forth between I'll pace him at a race and he comes to pace me and back and forth kind of thing.
That's fun.
So that's Chris Kulikin. Then my wife will come down and she'll crew. And then Don and his wife, Shannon Presniak, they'll come down and Don will be the one pacing from Forest Hill down to Green Gate. So give them a chance to hop in the raft and cross the river for the first time. So
how has your training gone? Like, do you feel like you're setting yourself up for success or have you had some blips along the way this spring?
This one's been a tough year. I've had a few blips along the way on this one. So things were going pretty good up through Christmas, January. And then early February, I tore my hamstring tendon. So there was kind of a big pause, setback in the training. And I was able to kind of, after a couple of weeks, I was able to get back into running, but I didn't know how quickly it'd heal. Would I be able to do any long runs? Can I do a trail? Can I run uphill? But after about 6 weeks, I guess, so towards the end of March, it felt strong enough that I felt like I could go. So I told the crews that I'm going and then let them decide whether or not they still wanted to come. So they all said, yeah, still booked their tickets and decided to come down and hope that I've got the training under my legs this year to do it. But I think it's come together. I've been managing. I'm not typically a high mileage runner, but I've been managing upwards of around that 100K a week for the last
good for you
6-7 weeks or so, and then used Blackfoot 2 days ago as sort of that the last longest run. So at 50K, and then I'll taper down to 30-ish next week and then a 20-ish and then ease into the last couple of weeks before the race. So
the hard work is done now and now you can just make sure you rest and recover and don't sabotage the result of the race by what you do in the next 4 weeks. Yeah.
That's right. So and as long as the tendon holds up, I haven't put the Mount Everest in that I really wanted to do. But I think as long as I can power hike it or walk up the hills, the time maybe now have to shift that goal time where originally I was hoping maybe a 24 hour would be really nice. Now it might be 26 or 7. So,
okay.
Which
well, is still better than what you did in 2017, yeah. Right? You were 28 yeah. and a half-ish.
Yeah.
So when you're thinking about pacers, like what kind of an athlete are you at, you know, 80 miles into a race? Are you like one of those, I'm sorry for what I said at the 80 mile mark, like in advance, or are you pretty level headed? Like, do you get really down if things are not going your way? How, like, what are you sort of like as a racer?
I don't think I get down, or I know I've heard of those stories of people who are like, what happens out there, that's not me. I just turn into somebody different at mile 80. But I don't feel like I do. I kind of more worried that I don't want to offend my pacers, my crews, because I want them to come back at the next race.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I kind of look after them at the same time while they're trying to look after me. So,
right.
Okay. Yeah, I tend to not to be too angry or too grumpy or too upset about things. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, everyone has their days, and
yep.
I'm just there for, I'm not never going to win the race or really any race anymore. So it's more or less, I just want to go out and have fun. Yeah. So I'm not too worried about that half hour difference doesn't make a big difference. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, it's Western States. You got to enjoy the process. And I will argue that, yeah, your crew will come back with you if you keep going back to Western States. That's like the ultimate privilege. I'm like, hands up, I'll go crew for you.
But was the reason that you kind of flipped it to them, do you still want to come because your training had that little blip in it? And so you're thinking, oh gosh, like what if they travel all that way and then they don't even really get to, they're coming for like a 20 mile walk in the woods or what was
that? Or would I even be in shape to get to the point where they could pace, right?
Gotcha.
Like, am I going to go there and blow up and really I'm done at Forest Hill? So I didn't want to put that pressure on them to say, yeah, I'll come down. I'll invest my time and money into being there when, if they didn't feel like the chances of me even really getting too far into the race wasn't that great. So that's sort of where that was.
You know, you've got some experience under your belt. So I suspect that if we're here a month before the race and you are, you know, still planning on going, you've got something deep in that tank that's going to get you across that finish line, short of frank injury.
Well, I feel I'm fitter than I was in 2017. So hopefully that translates to a result on the trail at the same way. So,
well, you know, Jamie, here's a little fun fact. We're going to talk about Iron Legs Mountain races here in a minute, your races that you drag. But I came and had the pleasure of running one of your races in 2017 and tore my hamstring at the top of Powder Face, somewhere up there, after climbing and climbing and climbing for what seemed like forever. Got cocky, stepped out to pass going downhill, and wham, like we're talking bruised on the back of my leg, tore. Like it was bad. And I discovered something during that race. Because I finished my 50K section of the 100 relay. You don't need a hamstring to go uphill at all. You poles and quads, you don't need a hamstring. You do need a hamstring to go downhill. So if you're out there in States, at least, you know, you can celebrate the uphills for what they are, because they might not, you know, stress out your hamstring as much.
Yeah.
Anyways, okay, so let's go there now. So you're going to go down to California into June. You're going to run Western States, and then you're going to come home to race season on home soil. So tell us a little bit more about your races, the Iron Legs Mountain races. When did you start these races and why? Like, how did this come to be?
I started them in 2009, and it was that January-ish, somewhere in there. I'd been talking to my wife about it, whether or not I wanted to put this race on, and because there was no real mountain ultras in the Calgary area, and I just felt we've got all these great trails and why not showcase what we've got and support people out there, because so many of them went out there and would run on them anyways, but why not provide this supported atmosphere for them to come out and put on a challenging course.
Well, and let me interrupt here. 2009 was right when ultra running was really starting to gain. It wasn't just the, you know, grassroots backwoods, you know, sport that it was for so many years. It was starting to become more formalized, getting very popular. Yeah. And you're speaking about trails around Calgary. So tell us where this race happens.
So back in 2009, it started and finished at Station Flats in the Elbow Valley. And went out and over the Powderface Saddle, Jumping Pound, Cox Hill, before looping back through West Bragg to the finish line for a 50-mile course. And that's all we had at the time, was just the one 50-mile race and or a relay team. You could do it as a relay team. And that stayed the same until when 2013 was the floods. So I had to cancel that year. And then in 2014, when I came back, I had to find a new course because some of the trails were still washed out. Bridges were washed out from the floods. So I couldn't go back to the original course. So I found a new one that was a tougher 50-mile course than the original one. And because of the difficulty level, I wanted to give people a shorter option. And that's where the 60K started. So they could then, if they felt like they couldn't go with the full 50 miles, they could have the 60K. And part of it was I changed the kind of the, no, not the norm, but most races don't do it, I guess, in that if you drop down mid-race, I still gave them a finish. So if you were a 50-mile runner that got to aid station for the last aid station on the 60K course and decided this isn't my day, I can't go on. If they went to the finish line from there, I would rank them as a 60K finisher. So it kind of skews the results and difficulty, I guess, in some ways, because it doesn't show as many DNFs as it could possibly. So, and then from there, it kind of, I just grew and then added in a 100K race. Building off of the 50-mile course, I added a little bit of L into that one for 100K. And then, 2 years ago, added in a 20K race, but that one's run at night. So you start at 9:30 at night, and you run the last, and out and back on the last section that the 100K runners are on.
So why that? Why did you choose to do it that way, to run 20K at night and potentially not midday?
Because there's no races out there that do a night run. There's trail half marathons out there. There's trail marathons. There's trail 10Ks. There's all these other ones, but they're all during the day. But I didn't know of any in the Calgary area vicinity, Western Canada, really, that had one done at night. So, and it was also a way of just putting a few more runners out on the trails for the 100K runners. So when they're coming in, it gave them a little bit of company out there. They'd have some people that come by and cheer them on and kind of encourage them in their last 10K of another tough race, right? So
I'm laughing because, 20K runners blowing by 100K runners.
And it is. It really is.
It can be like encouraging or kind of demoralizing, depending on where you're at in your headspace. But the energy is good. The energy is good when you have somebody who's buoyant and joyful. Yeah.
Or at least just saying good job. Congratulations.
Yeah,
way to go.
Exactly.
Right. Like, just hearing that, having somebody there and some people, they've never ran at night. So it's a chance for them to experience that without having to go and do a 100-mile race, right? Or a 100K race at night. So it's just a chance for somebody to have another experience that they may not have without having to add in huge distance.
Yeah, in a safe environment. Yeah, go ahead, Carolyn.
So I'm counting four races. You've got the 20K at night.
Yeah.
You've got the 60K. You've got the 50 mile, which is roughly 80K, and then 100K. Is that, am I missing anything or is there more?
Nope, that's, well, a relay on the 50 mile course.
Gotcha.
So, but I've noticed over the last few years, the numbers have really dropped in the relay. Reason, I'm not sure. Maybe it's because there's a 20K and they don't have to find a team. I'm not sure. So after this year, I'll decide whether or not I'll continue with the relay option or not.
So you don't have a 100K relay anymore.
No.
And so fill us in. I know there was a little bit of concern last year that the 100K race wasn't going to be continued to be offered due to permitting and such. What happened there?
So last year, after having the 100K for, 4 years, Parks decided that I wasn't allowed to have it because it was run at night. So after a few discussions with them and talks about how, you know, this is the fifth year that it would be happening, there's never been any problems, they allowed me to hold the race last year, but they also said, you know, don't expect to have this ever again. I don't think we'll issue a permit for the 100K or anything after in the nighttime. So that would also take away the 20K race. But then when I submitted back in September for my permit, I just crossed my fingers and I submitted as per the regular distances that I've had for years and crossed my fingers that I'd somehow get approvals. And they did approve me for it, but the condition is now I had my permit fee doubled, I guess, because I have to pay for a conservation officer to be at the race from, I think it was from about 10 p.m. till the finish at 2 a.m. So they now want a conservation officer in the parking lot for that time.
And what's the purpose? What's the rationale? Conservation officers. So obviously they're not worried about safety of the runners. Are they worried about parties and like...
It was more wildlife.
Oh, okay.
It was all based around wildlife being out on the trails and all these people. And I'm like, okay, well, we've got enough runners going through there. We've got headlamps. There's noise. Everyone running out there is pretty, I'd say, wildlife aware. They understand the risks and they know what to do when they come across animals out there because it's not their first time. But Parks have just said they want a conservation officer on site.
Okay.
Can't argue with it. I just got to pay the fee and say, okay.
Yeah. Well, it's good that the race can still offer those two distances this year. That's exciting. So that's one challenge you've experienced just in recent times. Tell us about some other challenges that you've experienced as a race director.
Injuries are the big ones that I always dread as a race director. Some of them I hear about, some of them I don't. I've had people who have done something to their ankle. They get to their aid station, they just say, I'm done. They turn in their bib and they go, and I never find out about it except through the grapevine that somebody's broken ankle or whatever. Or there's other times like last year where somebody did, I believe it was their ankle in coming down off of Powder Face. And we ended up having to get a helicopter to come in and rescue them and take them off the ridge. So those, as much as they're not, they don't seem like a big deal, they can be stressful as the race director, especially in an area that doesn't have the best communications. So you end up having to rely on sat phones and UHF radios and stuff like that and try to just communicate the best we can. And the sat phones are really the safety net that we've got out there because there's no other options for cell phone coverage. And then I hate the idea of running out of water. I've been to races where you come to an aid station and they're like, oh, here, you can have one cup of water because we don't have enough left. And you're like, but I got 10K to go. Like, that's not enough. So I try to make sure that we've put in more than enough supplies into the aid stations. And I know my aid station captains are like, no, no, I've got enough water. I'm like, no, you're taking more jugs than you need because I'd rather pour water out afterwards or give away a jug of water afterwards than have runners run out. And to me, not only is it a safety issue for them, but it also can wreck the reputation. If people leave a race going, you know, they didn't have a this or a that, or they ran out of water and I suffered my way to the next, or I had to drop because of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It really can ruin the reputation of a race. So I really try to make sure that the water's all there. Aid stations are well supplied. There's enough drop bags if I can offer those sort of services to make sure that runners can get around the course, because it is a tough course. And I know that, but I also feel that with the right support, none of the courses are like too tough for most people. They're all doable. They're all, if you want it bad enough, or if you've trained a little bit for it, you can get through those quite well.
Doable, but definitely respectable. I will say, you know, I experienced your course for the first time coming from Winnipeg, Manitoba, where it was flat. And so it was quite, you know, an eye opener as to what running in the mountains, you know, Iron Legs is a name that was very aptly chosen, but at the same time, like you said, doable. I think, you know, if you pace correctly, the one nice thing about the Iron Legs mountain races is that all the aid stations, you know, you always loop back to essentially a road or a place that you can get good aid in, if I'm remembering correctly. And if you want a crew and support and, you know, even volunteer, you're not hiking in for 14K to a remote aid station. You know, it's very accessible as far as support goes.
That's right. Yeah. Like they're all on roads except for one. And that one is, I guess it's still a road, but it's behind a locked gate. So crews can still go there. It's about a mile down a road. And then I can still get vehicles into that spot. So it's still great for crew or for the aid station volunteers. It just takes a little bit longer for the crews to get in there and to support their runners. But once they're there, they see their runners come through that aid station twice. So they So they can spend a bit of time there and see more runners come through and encourage everyone through before making the fairly short walk, really at a mile, back to their car and then down to the finish line. So.
Yeah. And I know you are recruiting for volunteers. I just got the email, I think last week. So if anybody's interested in checking out this race from the volunteer angle, definitely we'll link in the show notes how you can support. And if you're interested in racing, why should somebody do your race, Jamie? What is the hook? What's so special about Iron Legs Mountain Race?
It's a beautiful course. You get amazing views on the ridges. So it's tons of single track. It's time out in the mountains. It's a difficult course, but it's that feeling of accomplishment when you've got across that finish line and you look back and you look at something that was so tough, but you made it through. And it's something that you set a goal for, you strived for. And it's that feeling that you have at that finish line that it's different for me anyways, compared to some of the other races that I've done that I don't want to say aren't as difficult, because there's no such thing as an easy ultra marathon, but they just don't have that same level of difficulty, right? So there's that, I can see it in the eyes and the faces of the finishers when they come across and somebody's in tears because they never thought they could run that far, or they'd never thought they'd finish that quickly, or whatever it might have been. Or maybe it was a bear that they saw a kilometer before and they were just that scared. I don't know what their tears were from. That's right.
Yeah. Well, so you're speaking to what sounds like many of the upsides, like just that emotion and that connection and people overcoming challenges or conquering something they didn't think was possible, right? There's a lot to love about seeing people through those moments. But earlier you were talking about, you know, there is a lot to think about, right? When it comes to the health and safety and welfare of the people that you're, I guess, ultimately responsible for as a race director while they're out there. So I don't think people always recognize or appreciate as athletes that attend these races all of the things that go on behind the scenes to make it a safe, fun, exciting atmosphere out there. What do you know, wish more people would understand about what it takes to put on a really top-notch event as you do?
There's a couple of things, I think. A lot of people, like in 2013, when I had to cancel last minute because of the floods. The floods happened in June. And yeah, there was, 2 months until race day. I had so many people saying, well, just go find another course. Just, you could go out, go to this area, go to that area, or do this and that. And it's like, scouting a course is one thing, but getting through the permit process and the insurance process and understanding mm-hmm. all those little pieces that have to fall into place, yeah. it is so time consuming and it's difficult. It's not something that happens quickly. It's something that takes months of planning. Before you even open registration, quite often you've put in a couple of months of planning. So to be able to switch those gears last minute, whether it's that or smoke conditions because of the forest fires that we deal with almost seems like every other year now, all those sort of things that happen, it really, there's no easy answer as a race director. It's like either A, I cancel, or I put it on in whatever conditions that they allow me to. Because I've had to do that where it was a smoky year and the smoke blew in like 2 days before the race. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, I've bought everything. I've got everything. The volunteers are all ready to come. So it was sort of a, you know, I understand the risks and every person's different on what they're willing to put their body through. So it was, we're coming out, and if you want to come, great. If you don't, I understand, and that's your decision. But it's not easy as race directors to change those last minute things.
What you're speaking to is so many things that are completely out of your control.
Yeah.
And I think the message should be, having the opportunity to run these races is a privilege. Like when everything goes right, it's almost, you know, it's a gift, right? Because there's so many things that could come up. Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to add to that?
I mean, I guess it really that my version of a successful race is, regardless of what happens, if the racers never see that problem or feel the effects of that problem, then it's been successful on my end. It doesn't matter how many fires I've had to put out. I mean, my wife takes on huge roles every year at the race, from ferrying supplies back and forth to different aid stations, to picking up and moving injured people, to moving volunteers around. And as long as a racer never sees what those people doing, like all those extra work and putting out the fires, it's a success in my mind.
Okay. Well, you've been doing this race now for this will be your 14th or 15th year from the South, 2009. It would be the 15th.
Something like that. I've had
something like that, I guess, with 2013 in there.
Cancel there. And then no, because of COVID year, I guess I did run it, but it was virtual. Right. I just put on a virtual one that year. So it kind of skews the numbers a little bit.
Okay, so a long time. Let's just say over a decade, you've been race directing this race. Recently, you added a winter race called Racing Dusk, which I had the privilege of running on my birthday this year in December, which happened to be a very cold day compared to the days we've had previously.
I know.
Yeah, but still a fun race, you know, one that brought people out to the local trails. Is there anything else coming up, you know, in your dreams to add to your race directing repertoire?
I don't think so. I mean, I've had lots of ideas, I guess is a great way of putting it, but the more difficult thing is just the permitting and getting permissions to use areas. Like I had visions years ago of putting on races out towards Upper Kananaskis Lakes, like the High Rockies Trail and those. And I've been told by parks at the time, and even last year, I think I was told the same thing, was we'll never give you a permit for those areas. It's just too much risk with the wildlife and trail closures happening like so quickly and stuff like that. They don't want to give out permitting and find out that, on this date, there's some bear activity and we've got to close it. And we close it the day before the race and problems there. So there's been a few things that I've liked to do, but I think between the how busy it gets in on the summer for Iron Legs and then putting on one in December, I think that's as much as I can handle right now on the race directing side. And then I do coaching if on the side of that, and then my regular job and three kids and family. And yeah, there's only so much I can actually put out there. So
yes, it sounds like your plate is very full. And I think that's wise. I think it's wise to do the things that you do well, right? Yeah. As opposed to just casting a huge wide net and trying to do everything sort of mediocre, yeah. right? So yeah. I think that's pretty self-aware to know like, nope, this is the edge of what I'm capable of. But you mentioned coaching there, and you are a UESCA certified coach. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. So what kind of chunk of the pie does coaching take up in your life?
Right now, because I'm still new to the coaching and only a couple of coaching clients, it doesn't take up nearly as much time as the race directing side. So that's not too bad on the coaching. And as I get more familiar with it, and it makes it a little bit easier and quicker on the planning side of it too. So, hopefully it won't ever take up that sort of big volume of time. It's just something that I like to do to give back to people and give back to the community. Which is really why I put on all the races, because as much as they're under a corporation and a company, the company's only there as a buffer, I guess, for liability, right?
Right.
But I don't draw salary. Like, we don't draw salaries from this. We put back whatever we can back into the races, or we donate to Bread Creek Trail Association or some other group organization to have them come out and help out. So it's sort of a way to give back to the community. And that's sort of the same as the coaching side for me.
Excellent. So you've experienced running and ultra running and racing from so many different angles, as a racer, as a race director, as a coach, as a, you know, the partner of a runner who eventually got him into running. What have you learned about yourself over the last, I don't know, 20 some odd years of running?
That is a good question. I'd say I probably have more determination than I thought. And I've had a few people have mentioned that, like pacers and stuff like that, because I really, even in low spots, I've been able to push through, and that determination to the why, I guess, for that finish line has been fairly strong. So that's always carried me through in the difficult times of the races. And like so many other people, it's running 100 miles is like living a lifetime in a day, right? You have all of these micro emotions of the highs and lows and highs and lows. And you, at one point you think you're feeling amazing, and then you round a corner and it's like, oh man, I can hardly put a step in front of each other because of whatever has happened. And just learning how to deal with that adversity translates to just about any area of life that you want to put that to. So it's not just a running thing. It's something that you learn running that applies to any aspect of life.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Which is the theme of this podcast. We even have it in our intro, you know, how running really informs how we live, and how we live informs how we run. And it's a complete circle. So I love how you said that. You put that so well.
Yeah, you sure did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And you've talked a lot in this interview about the people, the community. Like, you do this for the running community, right? Yeah. All of it, like, you're of service to the running community. But one thing we like to ask people is, who has inspired you most along your running journey, and why? So does any one person come to mind, or group of people come to mind as somebody that you have found very inspiring?
I mean, I guess I could start back as a kid when it was my dad who would go out and run his 3 miles or so every morning and stuff like that. And I got to tag along with him once in a while, to seeing that dedication and inspiring to get out and move. And then you look at my wife, who got me into running and still runs to this day, and watching her after going through having kids and being able to get back into it and pushing herself and tackling those challenges. And so I think there's not really one big person or a couple of people. It's just all these little examples that I've seen over time. That's like, that's inspiring person, or that person's really inspiring to me and what they've been able to push through. Or so it's, yeah, it's not really this person who did this amazing thing, that it's mm-hmm. it's that accumulation of time and examples that kind of have pushed me into the giving back to the community too.
Wonderful. Wonderful. All right. So we like to end many of our episodes with five rapid fire questions. So what is your favorite running mantra?
I'm here for a reason, right? You're almost like, you paid for this. You paid to be here, knowing mm-hmm. the highs, the lows.
Yeah, yep, absolutely.
You paid for this. There was a reason. They are not paying me to do this. I paid to do this. To put it all back in perspective. Love it. Okay. Do you have a favorite place to run? So not necessarily a race, but just a place maybe you like to train.
If there's anywhere that I could go to race or to run, train, race, it's the Bay Area. I love the San Francisco Bay Area. So doesn't matter if it was Marin Headlands, just on the, over on the east side of Oakland in the mountains there, Mount Diablo. I've been there a few times and yeah, I love going back there.
And there's so many great races around there. Have you raced there? Miwok or Phase 50 or anything?
No, my wife did Miwok. I did, was it Mount Diablo 50 miler, which I don't think exists anymore.
Okay.
So I've been there, raced once, but I've been down there numerous times.
And, just for fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay. Do you have a bucket list race still on your list?
The one that I want to do still is the Black Hills 100.
And where is that?
South Dakota. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
It's so hot.
Yeah, it's in June, so at least it hasn't gotten too hot yet, but it looks beautiful. And I've been through that area once before, and I'd like to go back and see it on foot this time.
Okay. Do you have a favorite running book or movie?
I don't watch too many of them right now, but probably years ago, the one that I watched the most would have been Prefontaine.
Mm-hmm. Classic.
Yeah.
Classic. You're in good company with that answer.
All right. Final question. What is your favorite post-run indulgence? What will you be having at Western States at the finish line?
Once the stomach actually calms down, it'll be a burger. Mm. Yeah.
Again, not an uncommon answer. There's something about that burger. I was just on a run with a friend last weekend and the topic of burgers came up with still about 3 hours to go. And I'm like, it's too soon. We can't be talking about burgers yet. It's too soon.
Yeah. Well, it's got everything, right?
That's what I had after my 10K on the weekend. Yeah.
There you go.
No matter how long the race is, a burger sure does taste good afterwards.
Yep.
Absolutely. Well, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us. Yeah. It's been a pleasure to chat with you and get to know you a little bit better. And if people want to, you know, sign up for one of your races or for your coaching or just, you know, find out more about what's going on with you, where can they find you?
Well, the website would be just ironlegs.ca, which has all the races, coaching, and everything's on the one website. And then through that, the links to all our social media, whether Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and everything like that can be found off the website too, because I can never remember all the different things that they are. So,
well, I'm already planning, you know, my snacks and my place on the couch to watch the Western States live stream for, you know, all 30 hours. And it's exciting to know that we will have a local Albertan, and there's, you know, I understand 4 other Albertans and many more Canadians who are going to be down there. So good luck. Thank you. Be excited to follow along.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. It was great talking to you too.